From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with actress Ruby Dee. She and her husband, actor Ossie Davis, have spent more than four decades performing and showcasing the achievements of other black artists. Also today, I speak with Pierre Dulaine and Yvonne Marceau. They're keeping alive a fading tradition, ballroom dance. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of tenor Placido Domingo trying his hand at some pop songs. And our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the idiosyncrasies of California speech. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is actress Ruby Dee. She's been an important presence on stage and screen for over 40 years. Ruby Dee has also been an active participant in the civil rights movement, along with her husband, actor Ossie Davis. She's been associated with nearly every major national civil rights group, from the NAACP to the Black Panthers. Ruby Dee began her acting career with the American Negro Theater, where she first met Sidney Poitier. They co-starred in five films, including A Raisin in the Sun, Edge of the City, and Buck and the Preacher. On stage, she was the first black actress to perform with the American Lena. Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis recently hosted a public television series called With Ossie and Ruby. Ruby Dee has also written a new book of poems and short stories. It's titled My One Good Nerve. Ruby Dee, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Were you exposed to much theater as a child?
No, not that much. Not really that much. But I did, you know, we lived in a very rich community and Harlem, you know, I grew up in Harlem. And on Saturdays we wrote poetry in the library and we had music lessons and we took dancing lessons and like all the children at that time did, you know, everybody had a piano or something. Not everybody, but most everybody. By the way, when you read that introduction,
yeah.
I don't know that I was the first at the Shakespeare Festival to work there. But you must have some other kind of information.
Well,
but
all
anyway.
Your official bios seem to indicate that, so I don't know. I figured they've done their research well.
Yeah, not the first, but I don't know about that.
Okay.
But at any rate, so in a sense, I had a richness there. And my mother was a teacher. My mother...
Now, I had read about your mother, by the way, that she really pushed you to the fine arts.
Yes. She herself had wanted to be an actor.
Ah.
Yes,
yeah.
And she'd worked with Richard B. Harris in The Green Pastures, and she'd been a teacher and all that, you know.
Well, when you started acting, this was in the 1940s, there was still segregation in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure a lot of avenues that were open to young white actors who were breaking into stage and screen mm-hmm. were probably not open to young black actors.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, you're probably right.
Yeah, I'm probably right.
Yes, and that's true. And it has brought something to my attention that at some point in every black person's life, you come to reckon with the fact that you're black and things are different for you.
Was that when it happened to you when you were first starting to act?
Well, no, not really. Because I remember reading the magazines and thinking, oh, I was going to be like the starlets coming along that I read about. They get a 7-year contract and they go to Hollywood and they make grade B movies and they have all their troubles. And sometimes they go on then to have contracts and play in regular movies. Well, it didn't dawn on me for a while that that wouldn't happen to me, you know, that would. And the thing I learned from that experience is that there's an insidious growth in your consciousness. There's a cancer in the consciousness that begins to grow that stems from racism in our country. And you're not aware of it until it's there in your psyche and it begins to limit and inhibit and destroy self-confidence and make you not as daring as you would like to be or as bold and as... And you have to really learn how to be confident, you know, and to acclaim yourself for yourself. That's the insidious part of it. I think that's what's happening too in the cities with the crime business. I think not enough attention is paid to to blackness. We're not paying attention to the phenomenon of racism, and so I think when young people get hold of that, when it finally dawns on them, it's a shattering experience. You go all kinds of crazy ways, you know.
Well, you got started at the American Negro Theater. Is that what it was called?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, was that a place where you could do the kinds of roles that you were perhaps not going to be able to get in the largely white world of theater?
I hadn't been able to compare it then, but it was just a marvelously exciting time at the American Negro Theater. We, this place in the basement of the library on 135th Street. And as I look back now at those people who started at Abram Hill and Fred O'Neill and... Oh, it's with the dreams, hard dreams that propel them to Harlem from the universities into this. My respect for them deepens and grows. You take it for granted when you go there, but so yes. What were you saying?
If you were able to do the kinds of serious roles there that you might not have been able to get as a black actress on stage or screen.
Yes, well, but at that point there was no competition. I was there, and whatever came up during my time there that I was eligible for, I read and got it. I didn't think about anything else in terms of theater and film. Then the entertainment world began to come to the American Negro Theater. I mean, the first movie I ever did for the government was cast from the American Negro Theater. The first Broadway play that I was associated with stemmed from there, and that play Anna Lucasta, that starred Hilda Sims.
You met your husband there too, didn't
no,
you?
No, I met him in another play called Jeb, which was shortly after that. And then Harry Wagstaff Gribble from England, an English director, came down to the American Negro Theater, and he directed Anna Lucasta, and he brought it to Broadway. And it was a time when we attracted all kinds of teachers and black and white. And I think about Osceola Archer and Benjamin Samak and Curtis Cooksey and so many that came there. It was like a marvelous university in that basement where we studied acting and speech and dance, movement and writing, and I think about knowing Abe, I hadn't realized how much until now. You know, he's going, what a marvelous thing that those dreamers did, you know. I mean, for it doesn't matter what race. It's just at that point, and also they spawned a lot of people like. Gave birth to others who started theater groups like Barbara Antier and Roger Furman and
Lloyd Richards.
Lloyd Richards, yes, was associated there, and so many, you know, that group touched.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. Actress Ruby Dee is my guest. Now, you met your husband Ossie Davis when you were performing in Jeb.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you were playing opposite each other, is that right?
No, I started in that show as an understudy.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. The producer. Do you have the name of the producer there?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
Oh, anyway. it slips my mind right now. This was a play that had we known was going to be done, and I was thinking about some other people that from the American Negro Theater that I thought would be right for that part. But as it turned out, Ossie was from another group, the Rose McLennan Players, through Dick Campbell and his wife Muriel at the time. So we both came from groups, but we met outside of the group at this first professional thing that both of us did.
Mm-hmm. So I had this image of you playing opposite each other and
well, no,
and falling
I got
in love.
I got the part. I did, but that was part of it.
Uh-huh.
Because the girl that they had doing it for some reason was let go, and I, being the understudy, I stepped into the role before it opened on Broadway.
Oh, so this is really starting to sound like a movie. So,
well, in a sense, it was. I guess I don't know, but I did really get connected to my husband during that show.
So you were playing opposite each other.
Yes, we did. Mm-hmm.
I've always figured it must be very easy and, in a way, tempting to fall in love with someone who you're playing opposite with in a play.
Yes, I suppose I think so. When you're young and
yeah,
new at
yeah.
the business, because that and especially when you have all kinds of insecurities, and I think even above and beyond our meeting in this particular show, I would have been connected to my husband. I think it was like one of those quote, we were just meant to be,
right. You know.
And I remember watching him on stage when, as I hadn't started playing with him then, mm-hmm. and thinking to having a very strange reaction as I watched him. And that made me pay attention to my reaction because I hadn't really focused on him until that. Like it was like a sudden moment, you know, that I paid attention to him because I had been sitting in the theater kind of laughing at him with a friend of mine because he's so skinny, my God, and he gets these suits from the Salvation Army, you know, and he was like a pole in a big hole. A bean pole.
I want to ask you about another actor who played a significant part in mm-hmm. your life, and I'm thinking of Sidney Poitier. You mm-hmm. ended up co-starring in around, I don't know if I could, five movies together about.
Oh, yes. And then our families were great friends, and we still are. His ex-wife is one of my best friends.
Now, how did it work out that you co-starred in five movies? Were you almost like a package together?
No. I don't really know how that came about because we were just in the group together. I liked Sidney. And, you know, we've always been like a family. He's been like a brother to me. Like my husband and Sidney and Sidney's wife and we were all the four of us were a neat group at the time and we spent a lot of time in each other's homes and at each other's tables and in each other's kitchens and arguing and talking and discussing and so but I don't know how it was that we got put together in so many things, but I must say that most of the things that I worked in with Sidney were plays about men, you know, about when he was a basketball player and won, and you know, I mean, I did the woman role.
What do you mean by that? The woman role
in terms of my relationships. In most of the films I've done, you know, the wife, the girlfriend. The one left,
the long suffering,
the long suffering, the one yearning and pulling and rooting and you know, much like the relationships of black to white, you know, the existence is important only as it relates to the other. You know, it wasn't about the characters that I played as a rule. It was about the men that I was playing with.
Well, you know, one kind of like classic.
And still is a matter of fact.
Is it true?
About a play I'm doing now. The most important thing is, in this play, is my relationship to the husband. You know, the fact that I'm a nurturer and a protector and a rooter.
So this has been a source of frustration for you throughout
your
career.
Well, it's not frustration. It's just, right. I've had to think about that.
You know, one kind of
but there's a greater awareness now among women, so many kinds of things, like through people like Gloria Naylor and Bambara and Rogai and so many of the writers and Morris.
But of course, they're not writing for movies, not that I know of.
Yeah, but I want them to,
right?
And I want that. That's why I want to have to be a millionaire one of these days, so I can get these films done. I spent 2 years, for example, breaking down books, doing screenplays as best I could for around three novels. You know, just and trying to interest. You know. Get those things started. And I feel sure that will happen.
While we're talking about roles for women, mm-hmm. one kind of classic role for women, for black women, has been the long-suffering mother or grandmother, mm-hmm. you know, the very bosomy maternal figure.
Yes.
And this is a role that, to my knowledge, you haven't played, that kind of.
The maternal, well...
And the older, big, you know, there's a certain kind of body
like,
one has to have.
Like
that.
Mama in Raisin,
mm-hmm,
that kind of
that's
thing.
That's right, yeah.
No, I haven't done that, but I've been asked if I wanted to do Mama. And the thing is, I'd like to do Mama, but from a different kind of different perspective. Because that is that woman has a life and a longing and an aspiration and a thrust that few writers dare to explore, you know. And I think often mamas become mamas out of frustration, you know, the big bosom. They become cushions and solace places for their families and for their neighbors and for the world, because nobody's paying attention to them and they have nowhere to cry.
It seems to me you've usually gravitated toward serious roles in dramas. I'm just curious, were you ever offered, and I know this has happened to so many black actors, the role of the maid in a movie?
Oh, God, yes. My first television thing I did is something I think called The First Year. And I remember this. I don't know why it stuck with me all these years. But I go into the kitchen, and the lady of the house says to me, "Hattie, did you seed the melons?" And I says, "Oh, yes, I must seed them." And she says, "I mean, did you take the seeds out?" And I said, "Oh, does she do that?" They're talking about me. I guess I... but oh, I've done other kinds of roles too, like in Campanella's Wife. That was a different kind of role, and also Long Day's Journey,
But did you ever say no to roles that you thought were?
Yes, and I've said no to some things that I'm sorry I did say no to, because later I've discovered that. You have to say yes to life, and you have to say yes often in circumstances because you might be able to move in there and make a difference somewhere. You don't always have to agree thoroughly with something that you do. I always had a kind of feeling, well, it wasn't honest of me if I really didn't like this or really didn't agree with it to be part of it. But often the only way you sometimes an opportunity presents itself, and it's sudden and it's unexpected, or it's you can't always judge.
Well, I guess another trade-off too is that maybe you don't like the role, but the director's really interesting to work with, or something like that. That there's some other reason why it might be interesting to do.
And certainly not because of fear. So, for instance, I was asked to direct a piece. I never will forget Cosby once, when he was doing his show, asked me to come and direct. Suddenly, this was a sudden call, and often our blessings come in sudden ways. And I'd never directed a television show, and I couldn't imagine why he was asking me, but it was in a sense. The way things happen suddenly, I think you have to be alert to the inner voices and the guidance and the ways you pray for. Sometimes the answer doesn't come just because you can predict it. And I says, "Oh no!" And he says, "Well, I'll help you. I'll be with you." And I said, "Oh, I don't think I can. I've never directed anything."
So did you do it?
No, I didn't.
Oh,
because you see, I never did that.
So you think of that as a missed opportunity?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I don't lament. It didn't occur to me until later. Oh, that's how prayers are answered. That's how requests. This is how you grow. Sometimes it's unexpected
And scary.
And scary.
Yeah.
So, and scary.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't do that, and it stays with you. Like I was on my way to the bank once.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And I met this woman, and she wanted me. They were having a party in a senior citizen's house, and she wanted me to come up there and do a recitation. "Oh, Ruby, I'm so happy I saw you." And I said, "Oh no, I can't. I've got to get. The bank is going to close, and I have to get there." Well, you know, that thing stayed with me so long, and I've been trying to get back. And I left word, "Please call me again." I got to the bank; it was closed anyway. Because by the time I talked to her, it was all, you know.
Well, I guess there's a lesson there.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is actress Ruby Dee. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actress Ruby Dee is my guest. Now, throughout most of your career, you and your husband, Ossie Davis, have been really pretty active in the civil rights movement. And I guess that was especially true in the 50s and in the 60s. Mm. You were associated with fairly mainstream groups and also with some pretty radical groups.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that political association ever affected your acting career, and if you ever felt that you were perhaps not offered certain roles, or, you know, blacklisted in some way because of your association with the civil rights movement, especially with the more radical
groups. Well, maybe that could have been so, but we've never really seriously let that into our consciousness. It really never was a source of, you know, we've had some funny experiences, you know, during the McCarthy era. But it seems even so, was so strange to be, you know, the Red Scare had was pale in comparison to the Black Scare. You know, being Black in America is you know, 10 times worse than being red in America. As a matter of fact, you know, red goes in and out of fashion, and I suppose black does too. I don't know, but no, it may have done, and I'm sure it did in some. You know, we sent for some documents from the FBI. You know, you can do that.
Oh, the Freedom of Information Act.
Yes, and it was we howled. We just
what
howled.
Did you? What
I
did
don't
you find?
Remember now, but we looked at this and we just howled. It seemed the most ridiculous thing. So of all the things that we've deeply not been able to take that seriously. I can't imagine not having known some of the people that we knew, you know, like Malcolm, like King, like some of the people that we met in the Free Southern Theater, and like some of the Panthers that we met, and Angela Davis. I mean, I can't imagine living in a life and being able to talk to such people and not, you know. There was such a... I would be so much paler as a person hadn't I met those people and known about them, and the Eldridge Cleavers, as well as the Du Boises and the Robesons, and the, because as a matter of fact, the most exciting people in any society, I imagine, are the radicals. You know, they kind of keep the society moving.
Do you still feel that way as you get older?
Yes.
Some people who are very involved in radical activity when they're younger become more conservative or restrained as they get older.
Oh, yes. I think the most exciting people in the world are radical people, and you know, and who have ideas and who have passions. And as a matter of fact, any society coming along who doesn't have radicals ought to see if they can hire a few. Hire them, you know. It's like Abernathy said about the washing machine. You know, what is a washing machine without an agitator? You know what I mean? I mean, I just think it's the most marvelous thing to have these kinds of groups in our midst. And to squelch them in any way, I think, damages, or to take those struggling for prejudice.
How do you feel you've expressed that radicalism in your life and in your acting and political work?
I don't know. I suppose the best I can say of myself is I've tried to serve it, you know, in any way that I've tried to serve it. And also, it means thinking up new ways of, radical means thinking up new ways of for society, for our fellow creatures to exist on this earth in better ways than they exist now. I like the idea of, you know, not... I suppose because there's something in me that is not radical, that is timid, that is lacks confidence.
That's the impression I get of that personally. You're very shy, but that as far as the world of ideas and politics, that you take a much more radical stance.
That's right. But I don't know myself that well yet because I used to have a very violent streak too, you know. And although I've never, I first met my husband. As a matter of fact, we went to a. One of those galleries where you're shooting galleries, you know?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And he'd just come out of he was a soldier, he'd just come out of the army. And so I remember my first, I don't know where I'd learned to shoot a gun, but I mean, I suppose there's a radicalism in me that knows that the way to change, you know, for radical and root changes is through, is an organized and is not violence. But it's an appreciation for the necessity of forever bringing air into the... it's like a cake, you know.
Well, this combination of shyness and radicalism seems to me like a perfect brew for acting. I mean, yeah. I'm thinking that a film director I interviewed recently, John Waters, said that he thought some of the best actors he worked with were really very shy off camera, but would just come alive when they were performing.
Yes.
So, you know, to have that kind of radical spirit, but to be a little shy, I could see that really working in your favor as an actress.
I think an epitome of that is Michael Jackson, for example. I think.
Well, he's in a category by himself when it comes to shyness.
Yes, because he has an astonishing expression of so much of everybody.
I want to ask you something again about early in your career. When you were when you were young and newly married and you were bringing up your children, and it, from what I understand about you, it was hard for you to act then because you were busy as a mother.
Yes.
And then eventually you hired a housekeeper so that you could leave the house and perform when you wanted to.
That's right.
Was there a breaking point for you where you realized, I have to act? I mean, so we'll hire a housekeeper, we'll do something, I must act, I just can't stay home all the time.
Well, yes, and yes, there was. Because at first I thought, oh, to marry my husband, I loved him so much. And I remember writing this, thinking, I would live anywhere, you know, it doesn't matter. You're in love, and to have the babies and everything. But it dawns on you, see, having a baby and being a mother are two different things, but you don't know that until after you have the baby. And because they don't teach you that in school, which I think should happen in school, by the way, you know, about motherhood and stuff. So it occurred to me one night when my husband's on the road, that I'm home with the babies and the diapers and the plumbing and stuff, and I you know, that it occurred to me, and that there was a source of great tension, personal tension in my life, and fortunately, my husband is sensitive to things like that, so he insisted that I take acting classes and that I, you know, make moves outside the home. And thanks to relatives and friends and eventually to people that we had to hire.
So you did it.
Right, we did it.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I haven't seen you in much in the movies lately. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that's a conscious decision on your part.
Well, no, you know, I've been very busy, though. I've been doing, so for instance, three seasons we did with PBS, some of the most exciting work we've ever done with that mm-hmm. series. I mean, I can't say enough about that, some of that work, because I don't, and the writers that we had an opportunity to work with and so forth. And we were intercultural, interracial, and we dealt particularly with black writers. And I've finished a miniseries of, you know, The Winds of Change. And I did another one that was with Robert Wagner and Jacqueline Smith. And then I did a few months ago, I did a thing with Mary Tyler Moore and Sam Waterston called Lincoln, with Lamont Johnson, who was the director on that. And I'm doing books. I'm recording, you know. I'm trying to get a library going. I'm doing many things like that.
Well, speaking
and
of
I've,
books, yeah.
I've written a children's book for Henry Holt.
And speaking of books, I want to mention your new
book,
which is called My One Good Nerve. It's a collection of poems and short stories as well. And Ruby Dee, we're out of time. I want to thank you so very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
We are. Oh, thank you.
Thanks for being here. Actress Ruby Dee has been my guest, and her new book again is called My One Good Nerve. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with writer Robert Ludlum. His thrillers, books like The Osterman Weekend, The Aquitaine Progression, and The Metairie Circle, are almost automatic bestsellers. He's got a new thriller titled The Icarus Agenda. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we cut the rug with Pierre Dulaine and Yvonne Marceau. They founded the American Ballroom Theater, a touring company that highlights dancing in the style of Astaire and Rodgers. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of pop songs from an unlikely crooner, tenor Placido Domingo. And just about everyone can recognize a New York accent. Our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines accents from the other side of the country, California. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from
this news. This is Lori Waffenschmidt. UPI says Republican Congressman Jack Kemp will end his presidential bid tomorrow. Kemp won only 4 delegates in yesterday's Super Tuesday primaries and caucuses. But fellow Republican Pat Robertson, who also did poorly yesterday, says he's in the race to stay. The leading Democratic candidates converged on Illinois today, the site of the next big political contest. Details from Marge Halperin in Chicago.
Jesse Jackson showed his flair for symbolism by taking his campaign to the mostly white South Suburban Cicero, and the symbolism wasn't lost on those who joined Jackson outside a soon-to-be-closed factory.
We've lost 100,000 jobs in the last 2 decades here in Cicero, and for Jesse Jackson to care about that from a town that's hated his people forever shows what a kind of a man he is, and I want to support him any way I can.
Michael Dukakis targeted the working man, too, at a steel plant on Chicago's far south side.
Nobody's going to tell me as I walk around this plant that our steel industry in this country can't be competitive.
Albert Gore made his own factory stop today while Paul Simon stumped downstate. The Democrats and Republican candidates promise voters here will be seeing a lot more of them throughout the week. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
Soviet General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev suggested today that no changes will be made in the status of a disputed territory in Soviet Azerbaijan. Gorbachev told a meeting of the Communist Party leadership in Moscow that efforts would be made to ease social and economic problems in the Armenian section of Azerbaijan. Analysts interpret Gorbachev's comments to mean that efforts will be made to preserve Armenian culture, but the region will not be returned to Armenian control. Last month, hundreds of thousands of people demonstrated in the capital of Armenia to demand the territory's return. The uprising in Israel's occupied territories has entered its 4th month. 3 Arabs were shot and killed in clashes with Israeli soldiers today as Palestinians observed a general strike. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Jerusalem.
Today was declared Martyrs' Day by Palestinian activists. The call for demonstrations and a general commercial strike. 3 Palestinians were killed in clashes with Israeli soldiers today. The Palestinian Press Service reports that a 6-week-old infant died from tear gas inhalation in Gaza. In the West Bank town of Al Hul, a Palestinian ordered passengers off the bus and then set it on fire. Israel's prime minister today rejected calls from his coalition partner for an answer to the U.S. peace plan. Yitzhak Shamir is to travel to Washington next week for meetings with the U.S. Secretary of State. The foreign minister here is pressing for a vote on government policy towards peace negotiations before Shamir makes his trip. In Jerusalem, this is Deborah Amos.
11 members of the House Judiciary Committee said today they have sent a letter to Attorney General Edwin Meese asking him to step down until his legal problems are resolved. Meese is the country's chief law enforcement officer. He's under investigation for his handling of the initial probe of the Iran-Contra affair and for a number of personal financial dealings, including possible conflict of interest in the WedTech affair. More recently, he has come under investigation for his role in a $1 billion Iraqi pipeline project. Maryland Congressman Barney Frank is one of the 11 Democrats who signed the letter calling for Meese to step aside.
One of the defenses we get is, well, he's not in jail, and therefore he is qualified to be Attorney General. Apparently the notion is we should have a random selection among all those Americans who are not under indictment, and we'll pick our Attorney General.
The letter is the latest call for Meese to step down. Some lawmakers have called for his impeachment. Stock prices fell on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 7 points to close at 2074.27. Advances led declines 4-3 in active trading of 211 million shares. The average price of a share in New York lost 3 cents. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. According to classical music critic Lord Schwartz, opera singers have a harder time with pop songs than with more technically difficult operatic arias. CBS has just issued a compilation of previously released pop songs sung by tenor Placido Domingo. Lloyd says Domingo demonstrates both the exception and the rule.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Placido Domingo probably has the most sheerly beautiful tenor voice in the world today. It's creamy and dreamy. He's not much of an actor. He moves stiffly, and his phrasing is four-square. When he tries to act, as on the recent Live from the Met telecast of Puccini's Turandot, he's even worse. He seems embarrassed. There's almost nothing intense about him except the sound of his voice. But in opera, that can be more than enough. Domingo has also had considerable success as a crossover artist. His albums of popular music, from Argentine tangos to Viennese operetta, to duets with John Denver and Maureen McGovern, have been heavy sellers. I've always found him more compelling in person than on records. I want those miraculous golden tones, straight, unfiltered, and unamplified. So I've never particularly followed his recording career, especially in lighter music. But a new collection of reissues, Domingo's Greatest Love Songs, has given me a pleasant chance to catch up. The major problem with opera singers doing popular music is that they can't scale down their voices. Much of the best pre-rock pop was intended to be intimate, loving, or teasing. It needs to be almost whispered into a microphone, as if into a lover's ear. But opera singers tend to blast and belt as if they were trying to reach the upper balcony at the Met. The good news about Domingo is that he can scale down. Sometimes he gets too croony, but he can also sing simply with an irresistible, easy lilt. Here he is doing the last song on the album I expected him to sing well, Jules Stein and Sammy Kahn's Time After Time, written in 1946 for the young Frank Sinatra, one of the prettiest, least sentimental love songs of the post-World War II era.
Time after time, I tell myself that I'm so lucky to be loving you. So lucky to be the one you run to see in the evening when the passing years will show you've kept my love so young, so new.
The arrangement is inoffensive up until the very end, when it encourages Domingo to get a little too carried away. Same thing happens to Paul McCartney's Yesterday. The choicest part of the album are the songs in Spanish, especially the five songs by Cuban composer Ernesto Lecuona, including the famous Malagueña and Siboné. The style, of course, is in Domingo's blood. Nobody does these better.
Con impulso arrebatador, yo prefiero mejor morir que vivir sin tener tu amor. La inconstancia de tu querer, la alegría mató en mi ser. Aunque el temor de perder tu amor, hoy mi canto solo. Thank you.
But this compilation is also extremely uneven. Maria, in a souped-up, soft rock arrangement complete with echo chamber, is unadulterated garbage. One cut, Save Your Nights for Me, is so overproduced you can hardly hear Domingo. And some of the material itself, like the drippy love theme from Splash and other soft-centered, pre-melted caramels, is barely passable to begin with. Songs in English and Spanish keep alternating, so there's no stylistic consistency or coherence. CBS supplies no texts or translations of the Spanish songs. This is obviously an album intended more as background music for a romantic evening than for serious listening. But some of it is actually worth listening to.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Pierre Dulaine and Yvonne Marceau were champion ballroom dancers when they started their own company in 1984. Now they dip and lift and spin all over the world with their troupe, the American Ballroom Theater. They've taken the foxtrot, tango, waltz, and Lindy out of the ballroom and onto the concert stage. Jack Anderson of the New York Times called the company one of our most unusual and delightful dance groups. I asked Pierre and Yvonne why they decided to form a company devoted to performing ballroom dancing.
Yvonne and I had been dancing for 7-8 years together, and the time seemed to be right. Ballroom dancing is really coming back again, and you know, you should do something about it. People are wanting to see it. You saw a lot more ballroom dance, ballet-type move ballets now, Vienna waltzes, Liebesdieter waltzing in New York City Ballet. So we thought, we are ballroom dancing people. We should be the ones that are doing it. So we thought, we should do something about it, and this is basically the seed that made us go forward with it.
Now, how did you both start dancing, ballroom dancing?
I started ballroom dancing at the age of 14. I was brought up in England, and it was, at the time, the done thing to go and learn dancing, to know the social etiquettes when I was a teenager. So I was preparing for my teenage years, according to my father. School friends in my school went ballroom dancing, so I went along with them. I stayed with it, liked it enough that I stayed with it and became professional at it.
What about you, Yvonne?
I was a ballet dancer. I did little social dancing with my mother in the kitchen as a child. But my training was as a ballet dancer, and I came to New York to do ballet and could not keep myself alive. Obviously, there were a million ballet dancers in the city and looked for a job and thought, well, what can I do? I can teach dancing. And went to Arthur Murray's, and they trained me, and I got a job and met Pierre there. And we were there as teachers for a couple of years before going out on our own. So that's how I began.
So you really met through the Arthur Murray Dance Studio.
Exactly correct.
Funny.
Yes, that's right. Exactly correct.
Now, for years, you traveled around performing together and also entering into dance competitions.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What kind of, is there a group of dancers who basically tour the world going from one competition to another?
Yes. I think the world of dancing, ballroom dancing, can be compared very easily to the world of ice skating. In ice skating, you have the school figure formats, the competitive work that you have to show the judges. Then you have the free form, the exhibition form of ice skating, where you can do whatever you want. You're not ice dancing, the pair skating. And in our world, the competition ballroom dancing, you must show the judges certain steps, not in a certain way, but I mean, there is a way of doing that they must see. And then you have the exhibition form of competition dancing, where you're dancing on your own, to your own chosen piece of music, doing your own choreography. And it is this style of competition, what we call in ballroom dancing, the exhibition, adagio form of dancing, that Yvonne and I have excelled in. And that's how we made our mark in that world of competition.
Is it unusual for dancers to be partners for as long as you have, or is that pretty typical among ballroom dancers?
I think it depends. Mm-hmm. Some are married and stay together because they're married. It depends on how long your career lasts. It depends on the personalities of the people involved. Certainly the longer you're together, I would think, the better it is. One really becomes accustomed to the other person. And then the difficulty, as in a marriage, is that it doesn't go stale.
Pierre, what about you? Were there things you noticed right away about Yvonne that made you realize she would be a very good dance partner for you?
Yvonne is a petite person. She's only 90, 95 pounds in weight, 5'3", 5'4" in height. So whenever a person of that height is in the air and we are partnering each other in the air, she doesn't dwarf me. I am 5'10" in height. So the match with her picture in the air looked very, very good. So our height for this type of work is excellent. Our height for classical ballroom dancing, the waltz, tango, foxtrot, is not good because we would need to be more or less the same type of height for one another.
I guess Yvonne's weight was an important consideration since you'd have to be lifting her?
In our form of partnering, let's call it aerial partnering, it isn't that the girl must be a certain weight. That's for sure not the issue, because it is really the timing of two people working with one another. But for me, it was the look of the lady being off the floor. It must look as though she belongs there, not that it is an effort for me to get her there. And that was my thought on that.
Yvonne, you had to learn about lifts in the ballet world, and then you had to relearn it in the language mm-hmm. of ballroom dancing. What's the difference between being lifted and doing the lift when it's ballet and in ballroom dancing?
It's actually not the lift itself that becomes different in the ballroom world and the ballet world. It's the process of going in and out of the lifts that's very, very different.
And how's that different?
And that has to do with the balance. In ballet, the ballerina is obviously the center of balance, and the man rotates around her. Whereas in ballroom dancing, we share a balance. The man and the woman are both in motion. So going into a lift, we're both moving. Pierre, when he teaches, describes lifting in terms of an airplane taking off, that it rises on a curve and comes down, as opposed to a helicopter, which is more what ballet does. It sort of goes straight up. The lift happens, and it comes straight down. So those are the things we worked on.
Now, in a lot of the dances, Pierre, you're wearing a tuxedo.
Yes.
And Yvonne, you're wearing an evening gown.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the kind of clothing I would think of as being the most comfortable to dance in, especially the tuxedo, which is,
yes,
I think, much more constricting than the
yes.
kind of gown which is flowing and is meant to accentuate your movement. Is it hard to learn how to dance in garments like that?
It's much easier doing all of our work in rehearsal clothes. That's
sure, because
sure.
most dancers
yes.
wear
yes.
Tights, right?
Yes, it's much, much, much easier. But what we are portraying in our performances is Mr. Smith dancing with his wife, Mary Smith, dancing with one another and making it look as though they can themselves do it. And so we must look in the same manner as they would be going out for an evening, especially in our first act, which is the Rainbow Room.
We were happy to hear, too, that other dance teams historically have had the same problems. I mean, Fred yeah. Astaire really hated dancing in tails because they were restricting. And we were talking to Marjan Gower Champion, Marge Champion, the other day, and she was saying Gower hated wearing a jacket. But you have to for the look of it. It's what ballroom dancing is about. It takes place in an evening setting, and if you want to create that atmosphere, you have to look that part.
Where do you go after Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers? Do you ever have the sense of that, the two best have already did it? What do you do to follow them up?
The reason why we started the company is to show that if we didn't do it, it would then physically die out as an art form, if you want to say, as an entertaining art form. And for us to have started the company, at least now people can come and see us physically and hopefully be turned on to go out and do it themselves, which many people do, rather than just only rely on the silver screen and watch only Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. We don't aim to be Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. We cannot be. There was only one team like that. But I think we can help the evolution if it just keeps on going.
Maybe I'm just imagining a movie or something. Have you ever been in a dance setting where it's, just regular dancers on the floor dancing to a dance band? Maybe it's somebody's wedding. Maybe it's a restaurant. Maybe it's a nightclub. And you both get on the floor and suddenly really start doing your thing and everything stops dead around you. Everybody just stops and stares at you. Have you ever tried anything like that?
We don't go out social dancing together very much.
We don't go out social dancing, fortunately and or unfortunately, because we're so occupied with our own company that we don't have much time. And
right.
the last thing you want to do is go out social dancing when you've been teaching it all
sure,
day long.
Sure, sure.
But to answer that question, even if we were in that situation, many times I've stopped going out dancing when I was a little younger because people say, oh, show me this, show me this. We don't want to become exhibitionists in a social environment. And this is something that we would really steer away from, that type of showing off, so to speak, because I think you don't have to be a champion to enjoy dancing. So if there are people that are dancing socially, let them enjoy it, because that's what they know. You don't want to make better or being upmanship.
So you're hoping that you'll be able to keep this dance form alive?
Yes, I would like to do even more than that. I would like to see it expand. I feel, we both do very strongly, that dancing with someone else is a wonderful thing to do. And now the climate seems to be right for that kind of thing to happen again.
Okay. Well, I thank you both very much for talking.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Yvonne Marceau and Pierre Dulaine of the American Ballroom Theater. They perform in Philadelphia on March 20th and at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City on April 16th.
Stepping out with my baby, I can't go wrong, cause I'm in right. It's for sure, not for maybe, that I'm all dressed up tonight. Stepping out with my honey, can't be bad to feel so good. Never felt quite so sunny, and I keep on knocking wood. They'll be smooth sailing, cause I'm trimming my sails. In my top hat and my white tie and my tail.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news, and we've got both hosts here to fill us in on what's happening. Hello, Robert Siegel and Renee Montaigne.
Hello, Terry.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we have the Wednesday after the Tuesday, Super Tuesday. I talk, among other things, we have a report from a political reporter and from the Des Moines Register about the Iowa caucuses. Remember them and remember the predictions that came out of them and the real comers, Richard Gebhardt and Robert Dole. Well, the political reporter from the Des Moines Register predicts that we'll see neither candidates really nor much press next time around.
Also, people meters, know what they are?
What are they?
You'll find out.
Hey,
new,
great, thanks.
A new way of making television ratings.
Okay, well, stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on regional accents. He himself is a transplanted New Yorker now living in California. And he says whether they know it or not, those who frequent the hot tub and the freeway have accents just as distinct as the accents heard on a New York subway.
Here in San Francisco, spring is apparently in the air. At least the ranunculus and the Japanese plum trees have begun to respond to some sub-threshold climactic changes that passed me right by. Whatever you may have heard, California's really a very subtle place. Out here, you have to strain to perceive distinctions that fairly holler at you back east. Take accents. Eastern accents are as distinct as eastern seasons. They're written on the names of the places themselves. Boston has Harvard Yard, New York has 33rd and Park, Philadelphia has 4th and South. And within each locality, further distinctions of class, ethnicity, and age are marked on every vowel. One New Yorker gets a bead on another the second he hears him say chocolate, or chocolate, or chocolate, or chocolate, as the case may be. We Easterners are conscious of accents. We know that they place us in every sense of the term. When I moved to the West Coast 11 years ago, I was struck by how little attention Californians seemed to pay to these things. People out here didn't even think they had accents. Now, of course, that isn't possible. Accents are like hair colors and shoe sizes. Everybody's got one. But I think that what people meant was that there weren't any accent differences out west, that everybody spoke the same. And I can see why they would think this. After all, California was supposed to be the place where all those other American accents came to mix and mellow out. But in fact, people have been predicting the end of regional accents for more than 100 years now, whether because of universal conscription, population movements, radio, or TV. And yet, accent differences persist and flourish, even here in the newest world. The emergence of accents is inevitable because they're shaped in the mouths of children and teenagers. Kids are not interested in sounding like Tom Brokaw or Diane Sawyer, no more than they want to dress like them. Kids are fundamentally tribal. They want to talk like their crowd and differently from the other crowd. Over the course of time, the result is a natural divergence in the accents of neighborhoods, cities, and regions. So it isn't surprising that California should have its own local accents. You can tell a San Franciscan from somebody in Oakland or Berkeley by the way they say the vowel in a word like fog, for example. It's fog in the city and fog in the East Bay. Actually, these days it's usually fog in the city and sun in the East Bay, which is probably what's got the ranunculus all stirred up. But like plants, these accents have led mostly secret lives. It wasn't until a couple of years ago that the Southern California accent was dragged out of the closet to be celebrated by the Beach Boys and by Moon Unit Zappa in her song Valley Girl.
Grody, grody to the max, I'm sure. It's like really nauseating, like barf out, gag me with a spoon, gross. I am sure. Totally.
Of course, expressions like grody to the max are just local adolescent slang, but there was a real regional accent behind those fronted vowels in words like totally and good, an accent that had been simmering for years all over the southern part of the state. For the first time, Americans realized that Southern California wasn't just a place that people went to, it was a place that people came from, whose inhabitants had their own voice and their own curious native charm. But up here in the Bay Area, people still deny that they have accents. Maybe this has to do with San Francisco's self-conscious cosmopolitanism and its obsession with L.A. San Franciscans are always telling you how their city is much more like the great cities of the East in Europe than it's like that la-la land down south. They have a grown-up's pride of place, but no ear for their own tribal voice.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated for the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California.
I do not talk funny, I'm sure. What's the matter with the way I talk? I'm a vowel, I know. But I live, like, in a really good part of Encinas, so it's okay.
Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time I'll talk with jazz vocalist Cassandra Wilson. She moved to New York expecting a quiet suburban life and ended up in the middle of the New York City jazz scene. She'll tell us how it all happened. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Now and Zen, the new album from Robert Plant. Ken says that the music on this album is not as introspective as the title suggests. And film critic Stephen Schiff will share an appreciation of the late character actor Divine, best known for his roles as women in the movies of John Waters. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.